Hello, everyone. It's Scott Tipps again. It's Wednesday. It's February 6, 2013. Tonight, we're very lucky, and I'll cut to the chase on this, because we're lucky to have Sayer G with us. He's the founder and director of greenmedinfo.com. And I want you to write this down, please. www.greenmedinfo.com. All one word there on the Green Med Info. And just so you know, it's the world's largest open access, evidence-based natural medicine database. And Sayer G is also the co-author of a book called The Cancer Killers, The Cause is the Cure. His writings and his research have been published and referenced very widely. And in print, I could give you names. If you go online and you get any sort of information from some of these other famous online doctors and the like, you're probably getting information that Sayer G has dredged up in one way or the other. So you may ask, why is this all important to you? Well, actually, this may be one of the most important, Sayer may be one of the most important guests that we've ever had on, and here's why. So you're at a cocktail party, or you don't go to cocktail parties, so you're just having a beer with your friend. And he sneers in your face and he says, oh, you take vitamin C. So, you know, that kills babies. That causes people to burp. That, you know, causes hemorrhoids. You don't know what they'll say to you, but they'll say something bad about it. And when you try to defend yourself, what are you going to say? Especially when they throw back in your face or even before you have a chance. Well, you know, these drugs, they are, and there are quote marks around these words, these are science-based. They've been double-blind, placebo-controlled, tested, and they work. And why do we know they work? They work because science says they work. And so what are you going to say to that when you say, well, green tea does this. Green tea helps prevent cancer. Green tea is beneficial for people, or you say lecithin helps reduce bile in sort of sluggish bile, or you say vitamin C will help with collagen because it's one of the major constituents of collagen. If you don't have enough vitamin C, you're going to get wrinkles early in your life. So Sayer G has come to your rescue because with Green Med Info, you can take all of that information, you can substantiate it, you can throw it right back in their faces and defend yourself. So, Sayer, are you there to tell us how this works?
Thank you, Scott. You do me a great honor with that introduction, and I'll humbly try to live up to the description. And exactly, you've grasped the essence of the project. I have been in those situations, you know, at the cocktail party with claims that there really isn't research to support natural interventions such as vitamin C therapy for cold. Or recently, there was an article actually published last year saying echinacea didn't really help prevent colds. So I went and I looked through every published study on Medline, where our research comes from. The National Library of Medicine provides a brilliant bibliographic database with 22 million published and peer-reviewed abstracts. So when I looked through the echinacea research, I was very happy to find over 75 studies indicating its value, primarily in cold situations. So it's nice that it's open access, so you don't have to be searchable to put it up online or to log in to access each and every one of the abstracts. We've done one-line summaries, and we've indexed them across different databases. So if you're looking for the pharmacological actions associated with a compound, so let's say it's curcumin, you know, primary polyphenol and turmeric, and you're looking for something that reduces interleukin-6, which is associated with things like polymyalgia rheumatica, which is kind of one of these syndrome names, which are kind of pretty pitiful because they don't often look deeper at what's causing it. You know, statins induce a polymyalgia rheumatica type syndrome. But regardless, you can now select all the studies on the site that show natural compounds that downregulate a specific cytokine or a specific biological process. So it's really there to arm folks with that accumulating clinical research to support, of course, ultimately health freedom.
Right. Thank you. I appreciate that. And that is one of the things I noticed about your site, Sayer, is that it's so easy, incredibly easy to find information on it. It's very quick. And I really urge all of our listeners to go to the site. Again, if you're just joining us, greenmedinfo.com, and see how easy it is. And there, all the things you might want to deal with, all the topics, that is, are there indexed. And a lot of useful information that we at the National Health Federation use as well, quite honestly. We've found GreenMedInfo to be really the source of information, of accurate information and useful information. I just can't even believe that we ever did without it beforehand. Now, we do have one listener who's already asked a question, Sayer, if you don't mind. I don't know if this takes us away from it. But he's asked if you've ever heard of Dr. Tent, T-E-N-T.
Actually, recently someone else asked me if I had heard of a Dr. Tent, and there's a video, I think, out right now. I forgot where I first saw this. It was, on the autoimmune epidemic. I've heard of him. I'm not that familiar with his work, but I'm very interested. It's all relevant. We have a pretty elaborate section on our site on autoimmune diseases, both individual and then a larger umbrella page, which collates all the research on substances that can help to modulate immunity downward. Let's say if you're hypersensitized and your Th2 is overactive and attacking cell structures, well, there are a number of natural compounds and even probiotics, which have been studied in depth to get the immune system back into balance. I'd like to point out, too, there's a certain irony involved in our project, because the idea is really just to make people aware that this resource exists, not GreenMedInfo per se, but actually Medline, which is accessible primarily through the search engine PubMed.gov, because it's really like the convolution associated with medicine in the global brain. We have technologies today that enable the transfer of information at close to the speed of light. If it weren't for routers and such, it would be the full speed, but it's about 2/3 the speed of light. So you're dealing with access to information, which is really the byproduct. If you look at 22 million study abstracts, that's equivalent to probably about 22 million years of scientific labor. And what's so fascinating to me is that what happened along the way is in the past 20 years, we've now seen about 600,000 to 700,000 studies emerge confirming the value of natural compounds, because drug companies and even government-funded research has put all this effort into finding lead compounds, which they usually use botanicals and phytocompounds to find a drug prospect. So they'll find curcumin has profound value. You know, we have about 1,511 studies indexed on curcumin's value in over 600 diseases, expressing 160 different pharmacological actions of potential benefit. So what they do is they try to find a synthetic analog to curcumin, and then they'll bring it past the preclinical research. And of course, invariably, they find it doesn't function as well unless the research is manipulated, because you're basically producing a petrochemical analog of a natural compound. So it becomes xenobiotic, it's endocrine disruptive, it's going to have a profound set of unintended adverse health effects, which is the sort of whole pharmaceutical model. So, but in this process, they've actually put out billions of dollars of money to prove inadvertently the value and in many cases superiority of natural compounds to synthetic ones. I mean, it's a no-brainer to folks like us, but some of the research we've indexed now shows that, for example, bromelain, which is from the stem of the pineapple primarily, is more effective than 5-fluorouracil, one of the blockbuster chemo agents used for the past half century, which is extremely deadly at killing cancer in the animal model. So that's really reassuring to folks like us who really want to believe that natural alternatives and the body's self-healing capacity can be facilitated, and we don't need to be, taking drugs that ultimately came from the war theater, with mustard gas being the first chemotherapy agent. You know, we can use foods to heal ourselves. And so that's really what GreenMedInfo is about, is making people aware PubMed.gov exists. We have all this research, a lot of it funded by taxpayer money, and obviously exorbitant markups for drugs, up to 500,000% from cost. And so that's our resource. Let's all use it. And GreenMedInfo just takes some of those studies. We have about 20,000. certainly not as impressive as 600,000 to 700,000 studies, but it's saving you time. So you don't have to spend, 4 months looking at all the turmeric summaries. We've got them all, on our site.
Sayer, I just wanted to say a lot of people throw around that word evidence-based a lot, and I know you use it too. We use it at NHF and the like, but in your opinion, is the evidence-based model really free of bias? It implies that it's bias-free when you hear evidence-based, but what do you think?
Intrinsically, it's actually a rather demeaning, almost Napoleonic system, because it implies that the type of evidence that's real and valid and true comes through what I would call almost the clinical gaze. So instead of one's firsthand experience of taking vitamin C and realizing, wow, I feel great, I'm not getting a cold, that's no longer considered valuable. In fact, it's so low on the totem pole or the pyramid of the evidence-based model that's considered completely anecdotal and completely irrational, ultimately, because it didn't go through the, phase 1, 2, 3 clinical drug process, which is about $800 million up front to prove something so obvious that we know through our experience and then the experience of our ancestors going back countless millennia and cross-culturally confirmed, mind you, too. Some of these herbs are found throughout our planet being used for similar purposes. And, it's what helped us get here as a species. And yet we're pretending as if we have to, use these, the randomized double-blind placebo-controlled study and pretending as if it's not really millions and billions of dollars that's going into this model that truly is what it is about. Because, there's value, of course, to clinical trials. But when you're dealing with the golden rule of, those who own the gold make the rules, that's the obvious subtext in this model. And it's disturbing to folks like you and I who know this. And yet we know also we'll never see a vitamin C, in a true trial, alongside, a synthetic drug for immunity. It's not going to happen. Who's going to pay for that? So I find, I do use the term evidence-based medicine, natural medicine. I think that it's a way of bridging a cultural gap, but I also recognize its limitations and actually some of the darker sides of the model itself. Because it's about really transferring control and power and freedom away from the subject, who understands their body. They're living it. They use nutrients. They use herbs. And putting all the power into a system that is fundamentally dehumanizing, actually. So,
well, it makes sense. And why not use their words to support what we do so they can relate to it? It certainly seems to elevate what you're doing there. And that kind of leads me to maybe perhaps a rhetorical question, but I'll ask it anyway. Is there research to support natural alternatives to drugs? It seems like that's what your site is all about. So in that sense, it's perhaps a rhetorical question. But what would you say to that, Sayer?
Well, it's a great question. In fact, over the course of about 5 years, because it took about that long to get to 20,000 abstracts, because we had to look through about over 100,000 of them. So 20,000 was what we chose. But over the course of the process, under our indexes tab in the menu on top, the last option is called keywords. And we have a keyword called the superiority of a natural substance versus a drug. And we have a keyword natural substance versus drug, where there was a sort of equal potency. The superiority of the natural substance and drug keyword has about, I think it's about 250 studies where you're taking, for example, oral curcumin in an animal model being superior to injectable hydrocortisone. And then all of these studies looking at different drug compounds like, polycosinol, which is a wax that you can get from beeswax or sugarcane, being superior to simvastatin, also known as Zocor. And this is actually a human study. So we have found some really powerful studies. We'd love to get these into the hands of folks out there who can really popularize the information and make people aware that it's not just a matter of, okay, let's give someone chemo and then yoga now is some type of adjunct therapy so they, don't fully realize that they've been mistreated, because oftentimes the chemo obviously drives the cancer to greater malignancy and kills the patient. So I don't want to see natural medicine become just this sort of way of making the conventional system seem more legitimate, co-opting it. I want to show folks that truly the alternative, the natural compound, has been used for many millennia longer, and now there's evidence proving that it's superior, so that there are quite a few studies on our site like that.
Well, you know, I like what you have to say, Sayer. In our last issue of Health Freedom News that we put out, we had a book review on a book called The Drug Muggers. And the Drug Muggers book by Susie Cohen, and I'm sure you're familiar with it, it supports what you're saying. And she points out all the dangers in the pharmaceutical drugs, and points out that for every drug there's a natural remedy. This is something too that Bill Sardi has said for years, and what you have evidently said as well for just as many years, and that there all are alternatives. And so then why, in your opinion, do we have so much emphasis on the pharmaceutical drugs? I mean, just looking at the National Library of Medicine with all the huge amount of research that's housed there, who funds that? Who funds the majority, would you say, of the research in the National Library of Medicine in the U.S.?
That's a great question. I haven't really looked at the specifics, but I imagine that a good portion of that is taxpayer funded. But then there is also, you know, the private sector that is supporting public research actually as well, in order to, you know, obtain results that are favorable to their products. You know, what I find fascinating about the drug-based model of medicine is that it's really all hinging on the patent process and the ability to create out of truly nothing, like a fiat currency value, really from an intrinsically poisonous substance. You're able to leverage that against an imaginary value using, of course, the process of paying for clinical trials and ultimately statistically manipulating the results in favor of the chemical. So what happens is that you have very much a system like the Federal Reserve, you know, generating out of the void this supposed value, because with oncology medications, which are so toxic, let's take nitrogen mustard chemotherapies, which actually there's a shortage now, and in part because the Chemical Weapons Convention, which has over 100 member nations, says that you can't produce as a nation more than 100 grams of this substance a year because it is a weapon of profound cruelty, and they're trying to actually eliminate it. So, but it also has a medical designation. There's a weapon designation, medical designation. And this is what's given. It's actually been used as a mandatory chemo for certain types of childhood blood cancers. There's a shortage of it right now. But we're using literally agents of warfare, of course, not just chemotherapy. We have, you know, the, quote, radiotherapy, one of the most oxymoronic words you could ever devise. And we're now finding through the very research from the most respected organizations that these processes generate greater malignancy and actually select out the cancer stem cells within the tumor colony, as well as convert some of these inherently non-proliferative, non-malignant cancer cells into stem-like cells. So, of course, when you use these processes and you end up driving the malignancy at the same moment that you're debulking the tumor, because you're basically assaulting the daughter cells, which don't self-renew and can't actually migrate and cause metastasis, and you're now enriching the population of the malignant stem cells. So you're shrinking the tumor while you're making the cancer more malignant. And so when they die, you say that the cancer killed them. But of course, this is what's happening. And the research now is now clearly showing that even in the case of diagnostic radiation, like mammography, the wavelengths being used, you know, the 30 kilovolt peakage wavelength, which was known as low energy because it's lower energy than the 200 kVp wavelengths associated with like atomic blast radiation, it's about 300 to 400 times more carcinogenic. So everything is being turned on its head. We're starting to learn through the research that the standard of care is essentially really, in many cases, murdering the patient. But the liability associated with that is so vast that if the conventional medical establishment were to accept this research and really allow their patients to understand it, those who survive, the whole system would collapse onto itself. So it's tough, you know, because the research, I'd say, about 10 years out. You know, I live in Southwest Florida, and we have an aged population, and they're still getting their PSA scans when we know the U.S. Preventive Health Force Task Force says don't do it anymore, because by 80% of men have prostate cancer, and it'll never take their life. So yeah, it's been quite a journey just being exposed to so much research that runs directly counter to the conventional standard of care.
Well, I love your phrase there. The standard of care is actually killing the patient. Well, I added the word actually in there, but the standard of care is killing the patient. That is really something to quote there. And because it really is true. You just see that time after time. And if it doesn't kill them directly, then it kills them through the side effects of the medicine. So now, from all your research that you've done over the years, Sayer, and again, for those of us just joining us, I have on the air Sayer G. He's the founder and director of greenmedinfo.com. And I urge you to go to that website. It's the world's largest open access, evidence-based natural medicine database. So picking up from that, Sayer, in all your research, what are, from what you've discovered, what are some of the most extensively researched natural substances that would help people in disease prevention or disease treatment that you've come across?
Yeah, great question. I'm just amazed by the research, number one, on turmeric, and specifically the compound that they isolate out and they claim is the most therapeutic, which is curcumin. It gives the spice associated with the curry, you know, used in India, that yellow tone. There's probably about 6,000 studies now that have been published and that are now on Medline. And it's fascinating to me because the ancients, actually in Sanskrit, there was a word for turmeric and it meant truly the golden goddess. And when I first started going through the process of indexing all these studies and trying to get them on our site, I was amazed by the 160 different distinct ways that turmeric can modulate biological pathways in the body or gene expression. For example, it can upregulate telomerase, which is the enzyme that heals up the ends of the chromosomes, so the cells can replicate, you know, past, say, 50 replications before undergoing senescence. So for longevity, for example, it's really good to have a lot of telomerase activity because you can heal up your chromosomes and they don't bite at, you know, as you replicate, you bite into the ends and then it eventually bites into sensical code within the genes. So, but in cancer, you have the regenerative or immortalization instinct taken to the other extreme. So telomerase activity is very high, and that's why those cancer cells technically will live forever until they obviously cause some type of fatal obstruction in the body through the growth. But so turmeric has the ability in a cancer cell to downregulate telomerase activity. So that ability to intelligently respond to the needs of the body, in the one case, there's a healthy cell, let's make it more healthy, or in one case, there is a cell that's so deranged now that it's almost impossible to kill. Well, in that case, it reminds it gently, okay, buddy, time to undergo programmed cell death. Let's remember you're part of the whole. Let's perform our differentiated role and let's, you know, let new tissue come in your place if you're badly damaged. So that the actual intelligence of the ancients, you know, going back thousands of years, and the very word turmeric is now being reloomed by this massive body of research on the benefits. So turmeric is really number one on my list. And I came to the conclusion, this is in part through Dr. Duke's work, you know, the ethnobotanist who did all this research on the compounds inherent in different plants. But, you know, say on Tuesday you have inflammation in your shoulder. Well, your body taking the whole turmeric plant can say, let me take these 32 compounds and just lift it out of the background chemistry of, say, 1,000 compounds in turmeric. But on Friday, you know, there starts to be a little proliferation in an intestinal cell, a little precancerous lesion. Well, your body may take these 72 compounds and utilize that background chemistry the way that it needs. So, you know, we co-evolved with these compounds for such a long period of time that I believe that the integrity of our genes and the epigenetic expression of them now relies on the ingestion of them. So one doesn't have to necessarily do a heroic dose of turmeric. It's best to take small amounts earlier in life. You know, in the Indian culture, you put a little turmeric on the nipple before the first breastfeeding. So you literally get for the first feeding turmeric. Now, that's also a reason why we know that the Indians who are long-lived and exposed to many of the toxicities now that the Westerners are don't seem to get Alzheimer's. And there's now all this research emerging showing the reversal of beta amyloid plaque in the brain just administering curcumin. So there's such a broad number of properties. You know, multi-drug resistant cancer has been shown to succumb in the preclinical model to turmeric compounds. And so, yeah, I'd say turmeric, resveratrol, green tea, vitamin D. These are the most heavily researched compounds, and primarily, again, because of an acknowledgement by the drug community that they're looking for, you know, as sort of a poly pill, as they call them. But they always fatally destroy the inherent intelligence by isolating out one compound and then, of course, trying to alter it so they can get their, you know, couple decade long market exclusivity. So they literally must produce a poison for it to be valuable as a commodity. And no one wins in that equation, obviously.
Yeah, no, it's so very true. And I myself take turmeric in the 95% form, because there's some people that say that, you know, it's kind of a, I hate to use the word dirty molecule, but it's one that has some other things in it, and you need to get the 95% version of it, so to speak. And how much would you recommend people take a day?
The thing about turmeric, like, there's the 95% extract by itself, and then you have what's called phosphatidylcholine-bound curcumin. It's also known as BCM95. There's probably 30 different manufacturers of this standardized ingredient. But because the liver's job is to glucuronidate these compounds, and therefore they pass down the alimentary, they don't get through the liver and into the systemic circulation. That's good for, obviously, alimentary canal issues like colitis and, you know, intestinal polyps. But when you want to get it into, let's say, your joint because you have arthritis, or maybe you have a brain issue, then obviously having it be bound to a fat is good. Now, if you're taking one that's not phosphatidylcholine bound, you can certainly take it with a little fat in the middle of a meal, for example. Or one could do the traditional curry, which uses ghee, clarified butter, or you could use coconut oil. And so you're using really these ancient prescriptions for health, which is what the very etymology of the word recipe means, which is it's a medical prescription, and it's passing down what I would call an epigenetic inheritance system, literally as meaningful as the gene sequence in your DNA are these recipes and these traditions that now we're literally wrenching ourselves from, in part also because we're now in this era, as you know, of medical power and the idea that you cannot trust the evidence of your senses or your true culture, that we have to use this optic, this panopticon of science to determine whether something's true or not and how much of something you're allowed to expose yourself to, because now foods and nutrients are defined as drugs and even chemicals, you know, that require the toxicological risk assessment. So we're in a very strange realm. And, you know, I have to also thank you, Scott, and your organization, which is so encouraging, knowing that you're out there really trying to turn the tides on this draconian process that is really going to, it's going to be kind of irreversible if we're not, you know, being made aware of it and trying to change it right now.
Well, you know, you've done so much good work in what you're doing, and not only with this website, but in many other ways. And before I forget, I really have to remind everyone, or not remind them, but perhaps announce, because it hasn't been announced yet, but Sayre G has agreed to be on our advisory board for the National Health Federation. And this is a huge plus for us, and we're very honored to have him on there with, you know, frankly, Sayre, with your wealth of information. You know, you're just an asset to anyone. Well, in that regard, and I don't expect you to reply to that other than perhaps blush a little, but that's it.
I'm blushing, very honest.
You know, you've done a lot of work on vaccines as well, and a lot of our listeners are really keen on this issue because it really hits home. Either their children are being forced to be vaccinated or will be forced or the like. So, and Andrew Wakefield, as you know, has written a book on the subject about its relationship to autism and the like, as well as other problems that arise from vaccinations, certainly over vaccinations. So, in your opinion, is vaccine science really unilaterally in support of vaccine safety and effectiveness, as the authorities all claim?
That's the amazing thing about it, Scott. Thank you for bringing this issue up. Is if you look at the Cochrane Database Collaboration, where they review through meta-analyses the highest quality evidence within the evidence-based model of medicine, right? And you look at their findings on the most basic interventions, such as, let's say, vaccinating children under the age of two for flu. Their conclusion is so startling, which is that there was only one study ever performed on safety, and it was inconclusive, nor did they find they were effective. And this is based on global research over the past 40 years. And this was the Cochrane Database Review's conclusion. And then you look at flu vaccines in the healthy, you look at flu vaccines in the elderly, you look at flu vaccines for healthcare workers who work for the elderly. Their findings unilaterally in all four situations where they were not proven effective, and safety certainly was not proven. So when you have policies being made at on a global level for there to be coercion for getting folks to vaccinate their children for these things, and as being told that somehow they're harming their children if they're not doing it, it's absolutely absurd. It's not science-based. So I wrote one article called "The Shocking Lack of Evidence to Support Flu Vaccines," because that's exactly what I found. And recently, another one on the topic, which I saw you posted to the site. But that's one of my biggest passions, Scott. We have a database on Agreement Info simply on vaccination. And what we've done is we've taken all of the studies that slip through the membrane, which is heavily enforced. So like an example, what I find in the biomedical research community is that you have all this pressure pushing out studies that are proving, you know, the purported value of a intervention that is highly unnatural, like vaccines. And then you have all this negative pressure pushing in studies showing, you know, there are adverse effects. Let's take SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, and vaccines. There are several studies that were done before there was a complete global lockdown on this, you know, showing that the time at which this phenomena occurs, you know, shaken baby syndrome and sudden infant death, is exactly the time that most of the immunizations kick in. So, you know, for the infants, so 3 to 6 months. And they said the conclusion was, despite the glaring connection, was that it couldn't be the vaccines, because SIDS is known not to be caused by vaccines. So it's just absurd what you find. But we do have every vaccine in the immunization schedule indexed, and we have all the studies indicating the potential for profound harm associated with them. So it's such an important issue, you know, it's so important. Aluminum hydroxide being, you know, the new adjuvant instead of the Marisol, and all the research on it causing autoimmune conditions. And I mean, it's all there. Endogenous retroviruses, that's a huge issue with the seed stock used in almost all the activated vaccines, causing incorporation of endogenous retroviruses from other species into the human genome, which are associated with all types of cancers. This is a huge issue. So, I mean, the science, Scott, is so disturbing when you really look at it. It blows my mind that it's not even being discussed. You go to CDC's website, they don't even talk about the known issues. You know, the billions you receive, simian, SV40, you know, the SV40 oncovirus, billions of people through the polio campaigns globally were injected with this cancer-causing virus. And,
it's amazing. You're absolutely right, the lack of science that's behind it. I'm glad to hear it's one of your passions, because with the National Health Federation, that was one of our early issues in the 1950s. And even back then, the children who were vaccinated received only a fraction of the vaccines or vaccinations that they get these days. I mean, kids are, what is it, the last count, maybe you could correct me if I'm wrong, but it was something around 32 vaccines in the U.S. for children, unless someone opted out of the system by claiming a religious exemption or a philosophical exemption, which is possible in some U.S. states. But some places, like in Ireland and the U.K., they make it extremely difficult for you to claim an exemption. And indeed, they take children away from their parents and forcibly vaccinate them. So I think, you know, anyone listening to this really needs to go, if for no other reason than just this, needs to go to greenmedinfo.com, click on the vaccine or vaccination link that's there, I believe, on the left-hand side of the page, and it will take you to all of this that Sayer is talking about, and give you the ammunition you need to protect yourself from the authorities. You may not win, but at least you can bloody their noses with the real science and not the fake science that is often trotted out there and used. So I really thank you for that. And I also want to tell the listeners that in the next issue of Health Freedom News, we're going to have an article by Sayer on health and nutrition. And you've been so keen as well on health freedom, which I appreciate. And I think this is all part and parcel, in my view, of what you've been doing. When you do this sort of thing, research, and you throw a site together like this that's so incredibly full of information, useful information, I can't imagine anyone doing that who isn't active in or interested in health freedom. I mean, is this one of your passions too, health freedom?
Oh, right? Yeah. It's huge because, see, my sister's a lawyer and she's, very much an activist. In fact, we were both activists at our school, Rutgers. We both went to get our degrees. And she helped me understand truly the power of taking precedents. I don't know if they call them statements of authors, or when you're making an argument, you list the, you know, historical precedents for that.
Yes, that's right.
Well, we developed within the membership function, because the way we keep our project afloat is we have a professional suite of features that enables folks like who are naturopaths or MDs or integrative to take, let's say, the 30 studies on vaccines associated with autoimmunity, to press a button, and it publishes this page, which you can turn into a PDF or you can just link to, that lists every single citation, and it links right back to the National Library of Medicine. And so it's a way of adding arguments or weight to arguments. So if you're making a statement in the body of a text and you want to say, well, vaccines are linked to infant death syndrome, well, instead of it just floating there and you sounding like it's completely unfounded, you can link it right to a page you created on our site that has all the data that we've accumulated with that association. So that's the argument. Like, really what we want to do is empower folks, as you said, give them the ammunition they need to deflect really what is a sort of a crusade against awareness about what we know is true, is that you don't inject children with aluminum and expect them not to have adverse health effects, or put in viruses into their body and then expect that not to have an adverse effect. So, it's really about empowering people with the, quote, evidence, because this is the language of our era. We need to have science and evidence in order to even protect ourselves legally. And so we're doing our best to get that up on our site. And we asked 5 years on a volunteer basis to create our site, set up a way for us to parse PubMed articles so that other researchers can contribute. We have about 25 volunteers. So our system is set up so that eventually it can be more of a Wiki Commons concept of us all getting together to make this even stronger, because it's exhausting work to just stare in front of a computer for years trying to do this yourself.
Oh, I can imagine it. It has to be exhausting. Just looking at your site, you can just tell the amount of work that's gone into it. Sayer, what is the, in your opinion, after doing this research, what are the most dangerous drugs on the market for people?
Thank you. Yeah, statins are number one. That's probably our signature drug that we've indexed. We have now over 300 adverse health effects that we've linked to that drug class. And surprisingly, myotoxicity and neurotoxicity, okay, so damage to the muscle and nerve are the two primary side effects. Well, when you look at the heart muscle, it's a highly saturated, nerve-saturated muscle. So cardiotoxicity is actually our primary finding. And so we're working
with...
The cholesterol-lowering class of drugs known as statins.
Oh, statins. I just didn't hear the words you said. Okay.
Oh, it's okay. Statin drugs. And so there's so much research there. It's so convincing that it's a huge liability issue, because, you know, $30 billion sold of this drug class. There's a lot at stake. And the research we've accumulated, really, they don't want people to know. It's not just about myalgias, you know, muscle aches and pain. It's really about destruction of the heart muscle. Skeletal muscle, you feel it first because there's a lower mitochondrial density. The heart has about 5,000 mitochondria per muscle cell. Skeletal muscle, about 30. So when they start feeling aches and pains, subclinically, I mean, they don't realize this, but they're starting to undergo some cardiomyopathy. 2009, the Clinical Journal of Cardiology found in a human study that statins induce muscle weakness and dysfunction. So now we even have clinical human studies showing that statins harm the heart. So obviously that's absurd, and people need to know this. When it comes to other interventions or substances of real harm, I'd say a lot of adjuvants we've been looking at used in vaccines. We're looking at even basic over-the-counter drugs like aspirin. You know, the unintended adverse effects are rather significant. So a lot of the common drugs that folks might be using, we're indexing the other side of the story that just isn't really being talked about. So it's a good counterbalance. Now, we are biased in our methodology. Obviously, you know, we're not indexing all the positive studies, but on drugs, but that's not our job. We just need to provide you, you know, an alternative set of data so you can make an informed choice.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. And actually, I do agree with you that statins, in my opinion, are probably about the most dangerous. Statin drugs being one of the most commonly prescribed. One thing that I've learned recently is that actually the danger of even aspirin. Now, I haven't taken aspirin in over 40 years, but you know, there are a lot of people who take aspirin. They don't know that it depletes vitamin C. Back when there was the Spanish influenza after the First World War, and you know, 20 million people died actually from that, and a lot of the deaths were caused by overuse of aspirin. It depleted people's vitamin C.
That's correct. In fact, the meta-analysis that we indexed on antipyretics and influenza shows that there's not a lot of human research, but all the animal research shows increased mortality associated with their use, associated with influenza. So, yeah, that's now being proven, I guess, by the research. And we have about 50 adverse health effects associated with aspirin on our site. So there's quite a lot of data there as well.
Yeah, well, it's funny because every time I think I don't have an answer for something that I want, I either find it on your site or somewhere, but more often than not, it's going to be on your site. And so it's just turned out to be turned out to be a godsend in that respect. So so let me just basically, I think we have time for perhaps one more little topic, and you've kind of already touched on this, and that is when you talked about turmeric. But are there any other just as therapeutic natural compounds available today that you could recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, for myself, really sunlight exposure is number one. It's difficult if you're in higher latitudes and because of work schedules, but during the middle of the day, 2 hours on either side of solar noon, is when your UVB rays are present. And what we're finding is that that process of being exposed to those rays generates a wide range of extremely beneficial substances and effects. Melanin itself having the ability to convert sunlight into metabolic energy. And there's some research as well emerging that vitamin D sulfate is probably produced as a byproduct of sunlight. Now, if you're in the car in a sunroom, the glass actually filters out the UVB rays. And it's ironic that the dermatology associations tell folks to stay out of the sun in the middle of the day. Because really what happens, UVB generates new melanin through your melanocytes, whereas UVA, which is earlier in the morning and later in the afternoon, oxidizes already existing melanin, which is what causes photoaging and genetic damage. So midday sunlight exposure, huge. Now, if you can't get the sunlight, of course, get your vitamin D levels higher. Vitamin D Council 6000 use. You know, the whole genetic and epigenetic infrastructure of our bodies depends on adequate vitamin D, and just that little step, pennies a day, would profoundly reduce global morbidity and mortality. So that's a huge thing for me. Vitamin C is another huge one because we just happen to have lost the ability to convert glucose into ascorbic acid, which also makes us very susceptible to type 2 diabetes and weight gain because other animals convert excess glucose from the starch they're eating into vitamin C. So scurvy is a really big issue. And of course, ascorbic acid isn't really the same thing as what you get from vegetables and fruits. So the vitamin activity can't really be reduced to the skeleton, chemical skeleton. So getting the real organic food in its whole food form is going to be a huge benefit. And then other than that, I'm really a huge advocate, Scott, of just limiting grain consumption and consuming high quality fats as well as Juicing. I'm a huge juice advocate. Just amazing effects for our body, for stimulating healing. So that to me is a whole healthcare system in just a nutshell. It's just juice.
Well, I can agree with that. And even though I have to admit it's more in the case or the situation of the old adage, don't do what I do what I say, in my case, because I used to be more of a juicer, and I have to confess I'm not as much these days, although I recognize the benefits of it, so I completely agree with you on that. And well, we're near the end of our time, and we could go on for hours because you're a wealth of information on all of these subjects. So what we've done today is really just touched the surface. And I'd love to have you back on if you don't mind, Sayer. And thank you for that. And I appreciate your taking the time. And what I would like to say to the listeners is, please, again, Sayer G, and go to greenmedinfo.com, www.greenmedinfo.com. Again, the world's largest, and it's open access, evidence-based, natural medicine database. And we've been so lucky to have you on today. Thank you, and thanks, too, for joining the advisory board of the National Health Federation. We look forward to some many long years with you in helping to accomplish health freedom and promoting it throughout the world, as well as better health. And we like your way of thinking. So thank you so much. And
thank you, Scott.
All right. So have a good good day, good evening, and we will be in touch, obviously. Okay.
Appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right.
Bye.